This week, a public school in North Carolina has to pay up for firing a teacher over speech. In West Virginia, middle school track and field girls refuse to compete against a biological male, and they get punished for the protest. And the American flag comes down on Harvard's campus, replaced with a Palestinian flag. These stories and much more coming up this week on The Lion, Week in Review. Welcome into this week's edition of The Lion, Week in Review. It's a weekly look at the culture, the courts, your state capitol, and your kids. I'm Chris Stigall. Now, let's meet our panel, our award-winning panel, some of the men and women behind the stories at readlion.com. Josh Mann is the managing editor. Faith Perkins is a staff writer at The Lion. And Jillian Ward, ladies and gentlemen, is not only a staff writer at The Lion, but also Emerging Journalist of the Year with the Evangelical Press Association. Congratulations, Jillian.
Thank you.
And welcome to all of you. Josh, why don't we start there? You guys just got back from a big awards presentation.
Yeah, the Evangelical Press Association has it's fairly large and long-standing, over 50 years this organization has been around. But they have an annual conference every year, and member publications can enter different published pieces, videos, all kinds of multimedia into their awards categories, and there's many. We were really fortunate to bring home 7 awards this year, including first place in website design, so that was really pleasing. And as a managing editor, it's so great to work with great staff writers like who are on the show today, and Michael, our executive editor, who's not with us today. So kudos to the team, and kudos to Jillian, who took home, you know, Emerging Journalist of the Year award. That's a big deal, and
yeah,
so we're really happy. And it was a great conference, and it's also good because you don't win everything you enter, and you're with like-minded folks. You're pushing each other to get better. And so I think, you know, striving for excellence is really what it's all about.
And we should mention that it is not a small conference. I mean, when you talk about the Evangelical Press Association, we were just talking about this before the show, it's a huge competitive field,
mm-hmm,
right?
That's right. Yeah, I can't remember the number of member publications, and not everybody comes to the conference every year, but there are a lot of publications, and there's some massive publications. I mean, like the Christianity Today's.
Okay.
This is something that, you know, was started by Billy Graham and some others, and it's one of the biggest, most long-standing Christian publications out there. And so, you know, The Lion is just 3 years old, and so we're really pleased to be competing against more established publications.
And hard work. These folks put tons and tons of hard work at readlion.com, so I hope you'll check it out. Let's talk about some of the stories you guys have cooking there now. Faith, you have been covering some stories on these Ivy League campus protests. They've been evolving into chaos all over the country. What specifically have you been covering?
Yeah, so this week I covered a protest at Harvard where the anti-Israel protesters hoisted 3 Palestinian flags up on a statue that usually has the American flag up on it. And when they went to take it down, the protesters were screaming shame at the Harvard administrators who were putting them down. And this is like happening all over at different schools, NYU, I think MIT, and then also Columbia.
Is your impression that the administration wants to stop it, or they're content to just sit back and let it happen? Or do you have any read on it yet?
No, it looks like they want to stop it. They had 30 of the Harvard students actually get disciplinary slips, and they're seeing what they're going to do to discipline them.
Jillian, there's evidence that these are not just pure of heart college kids, but there's some rabble that have entered the fray that have nothing to do with the universities. Not to defend the college kids. I think there's probably a healthy amount of them, too. But what do you know about it?
Yeah, we've had instances of students going from their own college to a different college to protest at a university that isn't theirs. I've seen reports of even just kind of outside interest groups coming and helping foment this just chaos. And it's not exactly, you know, insurrection, but it's certainly students protesting against a university that really has no say in what's going on. It's rather ridiculous. And I think it just makes you wonder if these are the supposedly the best and brightest students, you know, at the best universities we have to offer, what on earth are they being taught in their public schools and their universities that they're behaving this sort of way? And I think it's going to make the next generation of kids really evaluate what they want from higher education and whether, you know, and not just you know, what sort of degree they want, what they want to major in, but what their values are and what sort of education they really want to have on a philosophical level, and not just go to Harvard just because it's the best school in the country, supposedly, but actually really think, hey, where are the values that are important to me going to be reflected, and where am I going to get the best education?
I was kind of wondering to myself, Josh, just kind of as a discussion point, does this delegitimize the prestigious legitimacy of an Ivy League school? Do these sorts of things make people think twice and say, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for this?
Yeah, I think it is putting a dent in the reputation of these schools. And I've seen one report, and I think it was anecdotal, but they had talked to students who'd applied to like Columbia University and have withdrawn their application, or at least they're not going to accept it. They're not going to go there. So I think it is, specifically denting the reputation of specific schools, but also there's a trend. I think it's related to this, but it's also there's other factors involved where early high school or recent high school graduates are not going in such large numbers to four-year schools. And so we're having more young people enter the trades. There's definitely more interest in that. So I think society right now, there's a few different trends going on, but it does kind of coincide. And I think it has the attention of administrators and, you know, a lot of the donors who have been concerned about the anti-Semitism that we've seen have said, well, I'm not giving money. And that is also getting the attention of the boards and the different folks who, you know, once you start affecting the money.
Yeah, this seems like a recipe for future disaster for colleges, Faith, because to me, as Josh said, with the donor money potentially drying up, with a lot of kids deciding, you know, in fact, I just read this week, coincidentally, online courses are growing and growing and growing. People would prefer, my own kids right now are talking about, I'd rather just do online, stick around the house. I'm not interested in doing the four-year thing anymore. It really does make you wonder. I mean, if this is not a recipe eventually for these giant, prestigious campuses and all their buildings to kind of collapse, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Could head that way. So it's definitely something we're going to continue to follow. I know you guys will at the Lion. Jillian, let's pivot to North Carolina, where a settlement was reached, thankfully, for free speech, but not without a fight.
No, so this story goes back to 2021. David Phillips was an English teacher in North Carolina, and part of what he did was there's a very prestigious summer program called at the Governor's School is what it's called, and he would participate in this. He did it for 8 years, and over the course of his 8 years, saw some of those left-wing ideologies like CRT and transgender stuff kind of start creeping in, and he didn't agree with it personally, and so he decided in the summer of 2021 that he wanted to host an optional seminar for students, so just a short lecture series where he kind of, it was a rebuttal to some of the ideas behind critical race theory, and he also kind of had some broader criticisms of just the lack of viewpoint diversity and then the lack of, you know, particularly conservative thought in education. And just simply for expressing his opinion on such topics, he was fired. And so he eventually sued the school for firing him and has thankfully reached a settlement. They agreed to pay him 4 years of what his summer stipend would have been, and also implemented a new policy at the governor's school that protects teachers' right to basically think differently than the administrators might. And so it's a very important case to win, and it really does go to just show how even in academics, people are becoming subservient and making the truth subservient to feelings. They don't care about facts anymore. We don't care about what's true, or even just being able to have, you know, different discussions with different viewpoints. Everything now is becoming subservient to how people feel and the emotion of it all.
It's a great point. And, you know, Josh, I was thinking about this, kind of dovetails with the college story. The Riley Gaines, the Ben Shapiros, the conservatives that have gone to college campuses, for instance, to speak, we've seen how they've been treated. They need security. Sometimes they have to barricade in a room. Simultaneously, you have sort of a left-wing agenda that seems to just want to run amok, run unencumbered, take over college campuses, fire conservatives unabated. I don't know how long that can last. In fact, I would say it's probably not lasting. It seems like it's starting to collapse on itself as well.
Yeah, these ideas are in conflict. And I mean, diversity, equity, and inclusion on its face would seem to invite diversity of thought, would seem to welcome different viewpoints. But we have learned that that's simply not true. It is a very specific and ironically anti-tolerant viewpoint. It only tolerates those who accept some of its premises. And there's just not room for, in a lot of these places, for right of center thought, and especially thought that has anything that smells traditional Christianity, traditional other kinds of things, family values. And, you know, it's a longstanding effort, I think, from the radical left to chip away at these traditional institutions.
This is a big question, Faith, but I really do wonder if we are coming to a place where we're going to have conservative schools and left-wing schools. I think of you guys, all of you, and I'll throw this to the panel, as journalists. Can you go to a Columbia or a Yale or a Harvard or, you know, a public school in North Carolina and learn journalism not from people that have a political agenda? Does that even exist today? And will we find that years from now we end up creating our own conservative journalism schools? I don't know. What comes of this, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you'd be able to, and I think that school kind of demonstrated it because they held a drag culture workshop, and one of it was titled "Dear White People, Get Out." So it's not very inviting.
No, that's it. I mean, Jillian, what of that? How do you learn journalism in 2024 and beyond from institutions like these that have this ideology that this is the way we're to think, or else?
It's tough. It's tough for sure. But I think that's a really important question, Chris. And in my mind, it comes down to the fact that I don't think it's possible to have an education of any sort that's completely devoid of any bias or agenda or ideology or however you want to term that. I think the reality is that every teacher, every institution, every administrator has their own viewpoint on things, and that's going to end up coming through in their work. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But what I think is happening nowadays and is just becoming more and more apparent with each passing day is that the amount of premises and assumptions that we share in common is becoming less and less. The premises of the left and the premises of the right are so radically different, and we have so little, I think, that we agree on, and maybe not as much as it seems sometimes. There may be still a lot that we could agree on, but it does really seem like the foundational beliefs that the different groups are holding really are just getting farther and farther apart. I think people have always had biases, that people have always had agendas, but I think when we had more of those foundational views in common, it mattered less because that stuff was kind of secondary, and we all held a lot of the primary views at least in common.
Yeah, and ideally the best teachers, number one, you didn't know their politics, I always found. And number two, even if you did, they were always inviting to a counterpoint of view and would challenge and make you exercise. Ultimately, to learn is to how to formulate an opinion and to defend your own position and opinion and meet challenges to that opinion. And of course, we don't do that anymore, but that's for another show. So, Josh, we turn to St. Joe, Missouri. This is a school district that just, I don't know if in peril goes too far to describe it, but it seems like there's new drama coming out of the St. Joseph, Missouri School District every week.
Yeah, and so we are doing we've done a follow-up. We sunshined the school because so here's what happened. And the St. Joe School District passed a $20 million bond on April 2nd. And the day after, the superintendent released a video on district social media thanking his own communications director for, quote, coordinating, unquote, with the campaign committee. Well, on the face of it, that is unlawful in Missouri. That's electioneering. To have a district employee coordinating with a PAC, a political action committee, is unlawful. And so we did sunshine the school looking for possible evidence just to do our due diligence. And that came back Friday. And so what we found is that, in fact, it does seem like multiple district staff use district resources in order to promote the ballot. The campaign for the bond, the ballot issue. And so so the video was really the smoking gun, but now we've got, you know, ammunition, shots fired. And so here's a few examples. February 7th, the superintendent, Gabe Edgar, gave an open invitation to all staff to join the campaign committee, quote, "We Are Forming."
Oh.
That was sent to all staff. And then later in the month, February 20th and 21st, we have emails from the HR manager, Heather Adams, and the comms director, Eileen Houston Stewart, with members of the campaign committee. And they do things such as edit pro-bond marketing materials. They talk about meeting times and agendas of the PAC, the Political Action Committee. And they even discussed a spreadsheet for district employees to put their personal email addresses in so that they could try to avoid the unlawful electioneering and start to communicate with personal emails. But
so they knew what they were doing.
It seemed like. And they there are, you see some evidence of efforts to, well, you know, we need to use our personal emails. And yet there's clear evidence that they didn't in a lot of cases. And so the Secretary of State in Missouri is the one who enforces these kinds of things, and complaints can be made to his office about that. But it does seem pretty clear that what the superintendent said in his thank you video is exactly what happened. There was coordination from district employees using district resources on the clock to promote this ballot measure.
Wow, and this makes you wonder, how often does this go on and how many school districts across the country, Jillian? Do you suppose this is just the one we know of?
I think it's pretty likely. I'm the type of person that likes to assume the best of people, that, you know, that administrators and superintendents and teachers aren't trying to do something wrong. But it, you know, cases like this do make you wonder. And I think people should be cautious about being overly trusting of the good intentions in administrators. I'm sure many, many do have good intentions. But I just think that as citizens and voters and taxpayers, we have to do our due diligence and always be aware that not everybody does have the best intention.
And it's important that, I mean, like you said, Jillian said it well, this is important because, okay, is it a minor infraction here or there? But to these are taxpayer resources. The infrastructure is paid for by the taxpayer. And so electioneering law is super important. And it's about the integrity of campaigns and election processes, because we don't want public resources used to promote one side of a campaign. It's in principle wrong. And so so these things are important. We have to keep an eye out for it.
Any follow-up to the I don't know what else you can call it, just kind of unhinged behavior of the school board member, throwing things, screaming and yelling and swearing that you guys uncovered on video? Has anything come of that also in this district?
Yeah, the board member, Whitney Lanning, who's facing harassment charges, her next court date's May 1st. She's requested a change of venue, which she may get. I have heard that there is some possibility that she'll be granted that change of venue, but the tape seems fairly damning, but we'll see what the court decides. But they just had a board meeting this week, and one board member did refer to the incident and was warned by the board president, we can't talk about that. But the other board member continued to talk about it, and so there seems to even be debate amongst board members about whether or not they can refer to the incident you referred to.
Yeah, there is one certainty I know, is that the attorneys for the St. Joseph, Missouri School District are getting well paid in the next few months. They've got their hands full. It's pretty clear. Faith, let's pivot to a story out of West Virginia. I've been asking this for the weeks that we've been talking about these biological males competing against girls. When do you think we'll see the tide turn? When do you think more than just a handful of women and girls will stand up and say, no, we're not doing this anymore? Are we starting to see the dam break here with this story? What do you know?
So five middle school girls refused to participate in a throwing event.
Middle school girls?
Mm-hmm, at a track and field championship in West Virginia in protest to a recent court appeals ruling which favored a transgender male athlete. He's 13, transgender boy, or biological boy. They ruled that he can participate in girls' sports because he's been transitioned for so long. So the girls, when it was their turn, they would go up to the ring, refuse to throw, and then walk outside of the ring. But then the next week or so, they were not allowed to participate in a track and field event. Their school wouldn't allow them to, and they also punished them by making them run sprints. And so they have gone ahead and filed a lawsuit against the Board of Education.
Well, that's That's going to be an interesting one to watch. Jillian, can you force young women to compete against biological males in a women's and girls' sport? I feel insane, maybe a little intoxicated for even having to ask that out loud, but what do you say?
It certainly is not the question one hopes would be taken seriously, but it's true. And I think it comes back to think of if you're a young girl, which I was once a young girl, and, you know, boys ran faster than me, just fact of life. You know, if we're not going to acknowledge basic biology that everybody knows, we know scientifically, we know experientially that this is just the way things are. If we're not going to acknowledge that, then the basis of the competition is a fraud. It's fake. It's not a real competition. And everybody knows that. And so to make young girls become actresses to affirm somebody's emotions is just ridiculous. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. If we don't care about truth, if we don't care about reality, and everything is going to be subservient to emotions, then we have to ask ridiculous questions like, can we force middle school girls to compete in sports against boys? It's completely asinine.
Yeah, and to adopt it, I mean, it's this kind of Orwellian thing. It's one thing to just say, you have to compete or you don't have to compete, but this is almost next level. You have to accept and embrace and endorse something, and that's now getting to a really frightening place, Josh.
Yeah, it is. It is frightening, and you know, I think we should have compassion for the biological male who believes he's a girl who's competing. Is it probably a little bit sad for him? Probably so, but our compassion for an individual facing those in that situation can't undermine the rights of thousands and thousands of young girl athletes, and it can't reverse what we've understood about Title IX, and it shouldn't reverse what we know from biology. And I think it's just really short-sighted for us to, in the name of inclusion, basically strip the rights from all these girls.
I will say, you know, while we're on this topic, at the Lion, at readlion.com, is the continued coverage of this story out of Pennsylvania, where a 12-year-old girl was assaulted by a biological male of the same age, new to this school, had only been there like 2 days, transferred in, and this biological male took one of those Stanley mugs, Faith, and hit this girl repeatedly in the head till she bled. The school district and most media in the Philadelphia area refused to tell that the assailant was a biological male. As a journalist, is that an important detail? Because a lot of journalism outlets, as well as the school district, tried to pretend that these were just two girls in an altercation. But as a journalist, I would ask, is it important that this is a biological male?
I think so, yeah. It's a biological fact, and it also is a big difference on physical strength.
Yeah. Jillian, in covering that story, do you think as a journalist it's important to be honest with readers that a biological male assaults a biological female?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had older brothers, and you know, growing up in a rambunctious household, you know, there's definitely an unwritten and also a written rule of, like, boys don't hit girls. You know, I would, you know, have pushed my brothers around on occasion. They're older and bigger than me, so, you know, it's kind of okay. But, like, boys don't hit girls. You know, it doesn't, it's just, you know, it doesn't work that way. And so I think people definitely see a story of two girls getting in a fight. Obviously, girls shouldn't get in fights either. Nobody should be hitting anybody over the head with a Stanley tumbler. But, you know, to have a boy doing that to a girl is, I think, particularly egregious. And it absolutely makes a difference in how people are going to perceive that narrative.
And, Josh, it's back to this ideology. And I know that, again, you've written a couple of stories about it now at readlion.com. This is a school district committed to trying to keep this story as just some sort of skirmish between a couple of girls rather than really what I believe it is, a social experiment that they're trying to keep secret. And a school board that is uniformly supportive of the policy. This sounds very similar to what we learned in Loudoun County a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and transparency, I mean, for that reason, parents have been really upset with their school districts about transparency. And our reporter talked to a teacher who would only speak on condition of anonymity because of fear of reprisal from the district. But that teacher said, you know, the superintendent claimed that, well, the story out there that this student transferred in from a disciplinary school from outside the district the superintendent said, that's not true. Well, the teacher told our reporter, well, technically it, the superintendent's right, but the student transferred from within the district. And so on some technicalities, it seemed like a more transparent way may have been for the school to actually just say, you know, well, here's what happened. But instead, oftentimes school districts will spin the story for their own benefit and or hide behind privacy law. And they should. They, school districts have to be lawful, but they can also do more to be more transparent because they are funded by taxpayers and they are educating the children that belong to parents. And so those are two constituents that they need to answer to.
By the way, as a follow-up to that story, you should know that that student, the assailant in that story, was in fact detained and sentenced to a detention center, I believe, for young people. And during that detention hearing, assaulted one of the officers in the hearing. So this is clearly an unwell child who a school district was interested in trying to hide. And I know that journalists like those you'll read at readlion.com will continue to expose those important stories. Let's pivot, Jillian, to spending in K-12 education. The U.S. Census Bureau has some new data on that.
Yes. So the U.S. Census Bureau, as you said, released a new report announcing basically that K-12 education spending in the United States has never been higher. There was a record increase between 2021 and 2022, a 9% increase in the average nationwide spending. So this is per pupil in public schools across the nation. The average amount of money that schools get per pupil is now, I believe, it's over $15,000. I think it's like $15,630-something. It's crazy the amount of money that public schools get to spend per student. And that's an aggregate of federal funding, state funding, and local funding. And I think numbers like this should make us ask the question, is public education, is the quality of public education really worth the almost $16,000 we're spending with our taxpayer money per student, when we have statistics like knowing that two-thirds of fourth graders can't read at grade level? We know that, you know, students are still struggling to catch up to where we were before the pandemic, which wasn't even that great to begin with. We haven't even got back there yet, when we know chronic absenteeism is skyrocketing. Is this quality, is this education really quality, and is it worth $16,000? And I'll just throw in there as well that $16,000 is an average. In some states, it is much, much higher. New York spends almost $30,000 per student, and so in K-12. So a little kindergartner they're spending $30,000 a year on average for that little kindergartner to do finger paintings, you know. And DC spends $27,000. The San Francisco school district spends $23,000 per student. So just absolutely staggering numbers that I think are shocking, and people should be shocked.
And naturally, Faith, this leads to, you start to hear the numbers that Jillian just rattled off. You're not even talking about a New York asking for an entire $30,000, but people who are supportive of the school choice notion would say, give me half of $30,000 and let me take it and spend it where I'd like to spend it for my kids' education. I mean, I think people are starting to really wake up to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you could go to a private school for a lot less than $30,000.
Yeah. Yeah. Josh, I mean, how many parents? I know, I believe you're a homeschool dad, and I don't know what that necessarily means to you, but for people that have their kids in private school or Christian school, you know, 15 grand is, that's a lot of money. In fact, it's more than most tuitions, I think, in most.
Yeah, that's Christian exactly schools. Right. And, you know, I think the key, as you said, is choice. Give families options. And create some more competition. The public education system is, it's not going anywhere. It is.
And have they ever spent less on it, by the way? Has there ever been a cut? I don't think there's ever been a reduction in spending.
I mean, not over any 10-year period.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the stock market. Every 10 years, you can pretty much guarantee it's gone up. And I think the question is, are we, like Jillian asked, are we getting out of it what we're putting into it? And if not, let's create some choice and give parents options. And you know what? What we've seen in states that do that, most people will stay in the public school. Some 80% of kids will continue to be educated in public schools. But let's at least give them choices, because it doesn't work for everybody. And we think that by giving them choice, we're going to make the public education system better as well.
Well, we always like to close each week's show with the staff picks, their favorite stories of the week at readlion.com. So, Faith, we start with you. You have a favorite story of the week?
I do, yes. One of our freelancers wrote a story called New Virginia Law to Help Curb Discrimination Against Homeschoolers Applying for Military Programs.
Oh, interesting. And you yourself are in the service?
I am, yes.
So this is a particularly important story to you?
Absolutely.
Oh, can't wait to read about it. Thank you so much. Jillian, how about you?
Yes, I've been following what J.K. Rowling, author of one of my favorite book series, Harry Potter, has been saying about basically women's rights and free speech in the UK. There's a law over there that is trying to prevent people from saying that biological sex is a reality, and that and J.K. Rowling has stood up very firmly against that. She's very pro-woman. She's very pro having safe spaces for women. Because she came out of an abusive relationship herself in her younger years, and so that's something that's personally important to her. And I love seeing people that, you know, who are rich and probably could just sit back in their vacation house and not pay any attention, you know, sticking their neck out and standing up for the truth and what's right. And that's so important to have as an example for young people and as part of the fight for free speech and for women's rights.
Well said. That's why she's the Emerging Journalist Award winner. Thank you. Jillian and Josh, your favorite of the week.
We've got a story on the National Health Service in Britain, which basically runs their health care, is changing their constitution to take out some of the transgender-friendly language, such as words like chest feeding rather than breastfeeding. And they do this after something else we reported on, a report that came out that talked about how a lot of their transgender quote-unquote care had no, there was no real evidence behind it. There weren't any long-term studies. And so they're actually making some changes that seem to align better with the evidence. And so, you know, again, Europe continues to be ahead of the United States in terms of pushing the brakes on this. And so I hope we pay attention as a country.
I mean, they've gone through it a decade or more before us, and they've learned from it. They're telling their people now, we made a mistake, we're reversing course, and we seem to be plunging headlong into it in the United States.
Yeah.
It's crazy. All right, well, that'll do it for us this week, folks. Thanks so much for tuning in. And each and every week, you can go to readlion.com every day of every week and check out all the latest news and stories like these that you heard today. So thanks for watching the show and downloading it. Hope you'll check it out next time on readlion.com and right here.